Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm David Platt, and I'm a member of the Asia-Pacific Forum here at the club, and I'll be the chair for today. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to new members of the club. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and any other electronic beeping, screaming devices. Now, here are some of our upcoming forum events. On Wednesday, October 7th, we will have Honorable Survivor, Mao's China, McCarthy's America, and the Persecution of John S. Service. The speaker will be Lynn Joyner. On Monday, November 9th, we will have Traditional Chinese Medicine and its Relevance Today with Dr. John Neeters. These are just two of many upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the Commonwealth publication in the lobby or check online for a complete listing of events at www.commonwealthclub.com. You can also call the club's 24-hour reservation line. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, who is Bo Timken. Bo is the author of this book, Sake, A Modern Guide. I had to look at the book to know the title. And he is also widely published in other publications on the subject of sake. Bo has many accreditations with the Sake Service Institute. He is a master sake sommelier licensee, Kikuzakishi, and he is also the proprietor here in San Francisco of True Sake, which is the first dedicated sake store opened outside of Japan. So please welcome Bo Timken.
So when you think of Germany, you think of what?
Yes.
And when you think of France, you think of? And when you think of Japan, you think of? And when you think of sake, you think of some white guy like me, right?
No. Indeed, I have two professional tasting licenses. I have a sake sommelier license, a master sake sommelier license. Last year, the Japanese Sake Brewers Union bestowed upon me a Vanguard title called, it's a horrible name, but it means a ton. It's for pioneers in the industry, and it's actually called a sake samurai. So I always wanted to be a ninja when I was a kid, but I'm a sake samurai. In October, SSI, a major group in the sake industry, is bestowing upon me an honorary Kikuzakishi title in October. But more importantly, I'm a guy from Ohio that sake just spoke to me. So I consider myself the perfect guide, because if somebody like myself can understand sake, then anybody can. And I can tell you guys are pretty smart people tonight for being here, because the alternative was you could have been next door on how to provide for your family and leave your legacy estate planning in a challenged economy. So you are indeed shrewd people. I have a couple goals tonight. And those goals are, have you guys leave here with a general understanding of a very mystical beverage. And two, I want you guys to walk out of here knowing that sake is not a fad, and that sake is not a trend. I wrote in my book that sake is actually a 2,500-year-old fad. But sake is a very powerful tool. It's a very useful instrument in the food pairing and the culinary scene going on in the world right now, especially which is driven so dramatically by who's ever been to a sushi restaurant? Sushi and the Japanese, let's call it food invasion. They're married at the hip, if I have to say so. Sometimes it's a bother to me that sushi and sake are considered in the same sentence. But 9 out of 10 times when people have their first sake, it's at a sushi restaurant. And so where there used to be one sushi restaurant on, you know, every 20 blocks, now there's two on every block. So everybody has access to sake a little bit more. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about components, and I can do this a couple different ways. Are you guys question askers? Can you wait for a Q&A session, or would you like to kind of make it a little bit more organic and go as we go? If we're drinking, we're talking. You guys bashful? Please don't be bashful. I'm a cold caller, by the way, and I pick on people very directly. I have my eyes on people. Again, do you guys want me to just spiel for 45 minutes, we taste sakes, and then all of a sudden have a 15-minute Q&A? Or should we just do it kind of a little bit more organically? This is the Commonwealth Club. Let's go. The ladder? Yeah. Which one was the ladder? I forgot. Organically. Okay, beautiful. And now, again, if you guys think of a question, by all means, fire it out at any time. So you came in. No, let's talk about the sheets really quickly. There are four sides. The first side is the introduction, and it's actually the sakes that we are going to have tonight. The back of that sheet is a sake 101, what I don't cover, what interests you. You can pick off questions off that, and I will definitely speak to a majority of what's on the back of that. Then on the purple or lavender or I don't know what color that is, periwinkle page, there's two different forms of manufacturing. Now, who knows what the word Nihonshu means? And you guys on that table right there can't answer that. Neither can you. Nihonshu is a very funny story. Nihonshu is translated as the wine of Japan. And who considers sake to be a wine? It's not a wine. Grapes make a wine, but sake is built like beer, but it drinks like wine. So it's brewed. So we're going to talk about sake breweries. We're going to talk about the process of being built like beer and drinking very much like wine. But what I want to do is I want to first ask everybody if they enjoyed that first sake. You did? Everybody did like that? Who didn't care for it? Be honest. Sometimes the first sake gets a little bit, a little boozy. People think it tastes kind of boozy? Clean? Round? All right. One of the sakes that we're going to have tonight actually has a little distilled alcohol added to it. Now, I'm going to speak to that, and it freaks out. As a store owner, it's the difference between a five-minute conversation and a 10-minute conversation. When I'm trying to hand-sell a bottle of sake and somebody says, well, wait a minute, that has distilled alcohol added to it? I guarantee you, you really won't notice the difference, and it doesn't fortify the brew. In fact, it makes it almost more elegant. So I won't give away which brew has the alcohol added to it, but we will at the end. Also, I will give one of these books to somebody who asks a great question or piques me, challenges me. So those who ask questions get gifts. And then my sponsors tonight also said that they want to give a gift to somebody who has the nearest birthday to today. So might as well just get that over with. Who has the nearest birthday to today?
August 31st.
Holy moly. All right, September 2nd.
All right, let's winner, chicken dinner.
Now we see what's going on. Why don't we go? Is everybody done with their first sake? All right, let's get that second one flowing and going. And when I said I'm going to speak in segments, I will do that. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on the ingredients first of all. Now, in the sake industry, people will talk about what is the most important ingredient. Is it the water? Is it the rice? Again, sake is rice and water. It is not distilled. It's fermented. And a lot of people in this country had the misconception that sake is a hard alcohol. It's a booze. But it's not. It is a fermented beast. So when you ferment something, the two major ingredients are rice and water. And what I'll start with is I will start with the rice first. I opened my store 7 years ago. And again, I just started learning on the fly. And then I went to Japan and got my titles. And so my goal is to get people to understand sake sort of from the street level, if you will. And so I had to create all these different little tricks to get people to imagine what's inside a bottle of sake, because it's pretty darn hard to take a look at that and say, yeah, I know what's in here by the label. Whereas if you saw the word Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon, you have handholds. Somebody was talking and asking questions about these reviews and how there's a word there and there's a beer and a wine. Now, what I did as to get people to understand sake a little bit more, I thought, well, you know what? If you can speak to your beer profile, if you can speak to your wine profile, I can put you into a bottle of sake under the premise that somebody likes a big Zinfandel and perhaps a big dirty cab and Guinness beer, they're not going to like the same sake as somebody who likes a Sauvignon Blanc and a Corona. So you will notice that each of these reviews has a wine and it has a beer and obviously has some food pairings and a word that kind of captures that brew best. So by all means, taste this next sake. Now, I did these sort of in an order, and this is going to segue right into rice. you categorize wine by the varietal, the grape varietal, Chardonnay, Cabernet. But in the sake brewing world, how do you categorize sake? Does anybody have any guesses? Absolutely. Now, let me keep picking on you. Why do you mill or polish rice?
To get rid of some of the harsher aspects.
See, harsh for you, but good for the rest of us. Exactly right. No, great point. What you do, not yet. when you mill rice or polish rice, which is the core of making sake, what you do is you're removing fats, minerals, proteins, vitamins, everything that's good for you, but it's bad for making sake. What you want is starch. And seriously, so the more refined the brew, the higher the quality or the different the category. So the minimum, go for it.
What's the best way to drink it?
Oh, thank you so much.
God,
I love you. I need your phone number. That's it. Thank you for bringing me back to that. Everybody, tonight we're tasting, and I want you guys to use all your senses, right? Again, I said sake is built like beer, but it drinks like wine. So use your wine vernacular. Use your schnozzes tonight. I'm big into the schnoz. So if you guys know how to taste, I'll walk you through it really quickly. But when you have your glass, what I recommend you do is you do for the primary aroma. That's here. You put your nose in the goblet. And what you do is you actually have to concentrate and isolate one nostril and then the other nostril. And then you get kind of put them together and you get the full aroma component. Now, there are 600 documented aroma components in the sake world. But like tonight, you guys can create your own. It has a cheese-like Velveeta nose, you know, and you're on the books. But then what you want to do is you want to take the same amount of sake in your mouth every time you take a sip. So you don't want a big gulp on one sip and then a smaller sip on the next sip because it's not fair to your palate. You want to take the exact amount. Now, I'll be honest. I had to do 2 days of sipping. I had to sit there with two cups while somebody watched me sip, spit, equal amounts every time, part of my training to get my palate sort of going, which, of course, we should be doing at 10 a.m., not at 5 o'clock at night or 6 o'clock at night. That's when your palate's at the peak. So what you want to do is primary aroma. Isolate your nostrils. Go one, go the other, and then take it all in. Your first sip, you take it in, you hold the fluid in your mouth, just like wine. Chew it, oxidize it, bite it up, dribble as much as you want. I encourage that. And then when you swallow, make sure you exhale through your nose because that puts all the flavor on your palate. So your perception or saying, should we knock it back, that's what I've been fighting against for quite some time now in the States because people think sake is a booze, and it's like a tequila or something, and that's why they serve in those little cups, right? Because we're going to shoot that baby back. But you're going to find out, no, that's not really – you can do it if you want. And remember, drinking's a luxury. Do whatever you want. Knock yourself out or knock it back. But I would recommend kind of drinking it like wine.
I just want to know how to get the best flavor out of it.
That's, I think, what we're just doing right now. So then in terms of alcohol percentage, too, people think that sake is distilled, 40%, but it's not. Who knows the alcohol percentage of sake, roughly? You're good. I'm going to cut you off in a second.
15 to 16.
And you said 18?
18 is high.
You guys are both right. Now, of all the fermented beverages, sake has the highest naturally occurring alcohol content. They use super yeasts. They'll brew up to about 20%, 18, 19, 20%. But for the industry, usually they'll add water to bring it back down to about 15, 16%. So when you're looking at a bottle of sake, think 15, 16%. And again, like wine, you don't have to pour this much and say, you know what, I got so crazy because it's so high alcohol. It's a 15%. One of the brews tonight we're having is 18%. But on the whole, the other ones are 15, 16%. That's that perception I have to battle, too. People are like, I get so wasted on sake. Well, who gets wasted on sake when they drink sake? Come on, don't be harsh. And again, I'm going to call on you when I'm in Japan. I have a philosophy to this, if you don't mind. I do think that everybody's body is beer tolerant, wine tolerant, and they're not exposed to a lot of sake. So it's kind of new and different and gives you that kind of new, different vibe. But actually, I'm just going to keep picking through these. Sake is the cleanest burning fuel out there. There's no question about it. It's rice and water that's been fermented, and that's it. Now, when you drink wine, you're dealing with sulfites as the preservative, right? Sake is pasteurized, so there are no preservatives. Sake has one-third the acidity of wine, too. So a lot of people who are acidity intolerant, sake will speak to you. Histamines, too. Who's histamine intolerant? You know what? Sake is a cleaner burning fuel without question. So you can drink a lot of it and wake up the next day and actually be productive, in a manner of speaking. All right. You guys are now drinking a Jumai. This brew has been milled, polished, a minimum of 30% removal, 70% remaining. That means they took that grain of rice and they polished away 30% of that grain. Now, in the industry, if you can mill a sake to less, but you have to put that number on the label. But just think of Jumai, the term, as about 30% removal with 70% remaining on each grain of rice. Sake number 3 is another form of Jumai. Sake number 4 is a Ginjo. A Ginjo is 40% removal, 50% remaining. You'll see those on the cheat sheet. And then the high end is the Daiginjo, where they're removing about 50% of each grain of rice with about 50% remaining. So those are the prides of the industry, and we'll talk about those. Go.
Yeah, my question is, what you have Jumai and then it says Chikuri and Fukunari. Which one is the name of the sake?
Welcome to my world. Welcome to my world. As a guy from Ohio, I had to go through these, and trust me. It's a great question. The brewery in Okayama Prefecture is called Chikurin. Now, there's a bunch of different names. There's a family name, there's a brewery name, and then there's a product line name. This is the product line name. Now, somebody remind me in a couple minutes, who knows the concept of terroir? In the wine world, terroir. Regionality, right? Local components producing a flavor. In Japan, they refer to terroir as tewa. And tewa is same concept, but they've lost that. They've lost tewa in Japan because of modernization and the transportation of materials, and I'll tell you why. But this brew that you're tasting right now, the Chikurin, is made using all local ingredients, and it's very unusual. And the guy, he's a great guy, is big into organic. So this is the first organic brew you're tasting tonight, too. I'm going to throw it out. Between the two, who likes the first sake, who likes the second sake? Second. Hands. Let's see hands. Second. Now, was this one a little bit warmer when you drank it? One of the reasons why Jumai, the category, does better at a more of a room temperature, coming into room temperature. Categories, again, let's get it. I want you guys to remember this now, because when you go at the end of this, I want you to go to a sake or sushi restaurant, and I want you to be able to take a look at a menu and say, oh, that's a Jumai, Ginjo, Daiginjo. I want you guys to know the grades, the categories. So this guy, the first brew in this room is a Jumai, 30% removal, 70% remaining. Now, Jumais, since they still have a lot of that outside of each grain of rice, they still have those fats, minerals, proteins, and vitamins, they have more structure. They have more backbone. Now, when you mill something 50%, sometimes 40%, sometimes I have a sake in my store that they mill polish down to 14%. They remove... Does anybody remember Jizzabop? What was that thing called? They did fingers? 86% of each grain of rice. It's fascinating. But now people will say, oh, Daiginjos, those are the best brews in the business. And they're considered the best brews because they've been most polished and pampered. But as a category, each category has best brews in that category. Sorry, if I could just run here. Daiginjos, typically the last sake we're going to taste, are good for sort of clean flavors. Just, you know, drinking by itself predominantly or very light pairing flavors. Ginjo that we're going to have that you started out with, your first brew, clean. Those guys are very good for, I'm going to say it, sushi, sashimi, very clean flavors. And then the Jumai category, this is center of the plate stuff. This is where you're getting your beefier flavors. And I want people to start thinking kind of in terms of Jumai. Daiginjos are beautiful. By the way, does anybody know the categories of sake? How many people have had cold sake before? How many people have had hot, crappy sake? How many people like hot, crappy sake? How many people knew that was the only thing that existed out there? I did. I mean, I was weaned on Benihana crappy hot sake, and I thought that was the way of the world. And then I remember tasting premium sake for the first time, and this was, of all places, in South Africa 16 years ago. And that day, I didn't know it, but it changed my life forever. There were two Japanese fishermen sitting at this counter, and they were like, what are you drinking? And I said, what are you drinking? They had this beautiful bottle. I was drinking my little cup of hot sake with my tokuri. I was like, what are you guys drinking? And they said, what are you drinking? And I said, I'm drinking sake. Sake. And they're like, oh, you're drinking sake? Okay. And they're picking on me. So, and they were like, you should taste this. So I was like, okay, let me try that. And the older guy said, wait, taste yours first. So I tasted mine. And he said, now taste this. And I tasted theirs. And the guy looked at me. My jaw must have hit the floor. But the guy looked at me and he said, same. I was like, there's no way that was the same. What I tasted, the two things, they would never be the same again. So the seed was kind of planted then. And then I would go on this pilgrimage where wherever I went to a sushi restaurant, I'd say like, do you guys, by the way, let's say, who knows how to say sake properly? It's not sake. Sake. You kind of slur it. Pretend you're liquored up. Sake. That's what I do. Sake. So I would go on a pilgrimage and I'd go to sushi restaurants and I'd say, hey, do you guys have a sake menu? And the guy's like, yeah, here's a couple bottles there. I was like, no. What do you like? What do you drink? Yeah, what's that bottle that you have down there? Every sushi chef has that bottle. So these guys started teaching me. He's like, you like Yamagata Prefecture? I was like, yeah. So I didn't know what Yamagata Prefecture was. So I'd start taking these and tasting it and writing notes, and I started a journal. That first night that I tasted sake in Cape Town, I started a sake journal. I went back. I was like, how could rice and water taste like cantaloupe, honeydew? How? Please explain that to me. So that's why I try to answer that question every day, and that's what keeps bringing me back to sake. So categories. Now, the components. Again, what have we learned so far? Sake is a distilled beverage, right? Wrong. Sake is made of sugars, brewed, fermented. We could make sake right now. This is one of the great ways to produce sake if we want to. You could take steamed rice, put it in your mouth, chew it up, and spit it into a bucket, and you would have sake. Should we do it? Would anybody drink it? Now, historically, that's how sake was made. But they wouldn't just let any yoshi do it. They always had the village virgins do it. The traditional, I'm not joking. Do we have any virgins tonight? So the enzymes in your mouth would break the long chain starch molecule into a glucose. Glucose gets broken into alcohol. Sake, they do that in one step when they brew sake, where beer is a two-step process. When you make sake, you do sacrification and sacrification. You're breaking the long chain starch molecule into the glucose, and you do fermentation in the same vat, but we'll talk about that really quickly. Categories, Jumai, Jumai Ginjo, Jumai Dai Ginjo. I said Jumai three times there. Why? Jumai means two things. You'll see in your sheet. It means a category, a milling percentage of 30% removal, 70% remaining. It also means rice and water only. What did I start with this by saying? Some of these sakes have added alcohol, right? You cannot call a brew a Jumai if it has added alcohol to it. So there's Jumai, Jumai Ginjo, Jumai Dai Ginjo. You'll see the milling rates there. If you add alcohol to a milled percentage, you call it Hanjozo, or you call it Ginjo, or you call it Dai Ginjo. I'm cheating now. I'm giving you guys the answer to the question at the end of the lesson. Rice. There are about 60 different brewing varietals out there that are in use, that are in play. And what makes good brewing rice? Good brewing rice is twice as glutinous as a regular rice. So when you eat a brewing rice, it's just too sweet. It's too mealy. It's not good for consumption. But you want starch. That's the end game. Like grapes, who knows grapes? There are better regions for growing rice. Some rice does very well in areas, winemakers chime in, where it's very hot during the day and very cold at night. You stress out. Inside each grain of rice, there's a thing called shimpaku, which is a little area that expands during the day and contracts at night. So great brewing rice is big grain, very hard on the outside, and very soft on the inside. Hard on the outside so it can take the friction of milling, of polishing, and won't crack. And it's very soft on the inside so it absorbs water, because you need to absorb water so then you can steam it. We're going to talk about that when we do production. Does everybody have the categories down? Okay, here's a little trick. When you go to a restaurant and you're ordering sake, typically what you would like to do, by the way, drink a beer first. That's the way they do it, right? Taisho? Okay. So you would go to, what I would predominantly do is I'd look at the menu, and I would order a daiginjo, because you notice daiginjos are the most expensive sakes on the menu. I would start with the daiginjo, get the flavor going, a glass of that, and then I would go down to the Jumai category. Now, another hint. If the restaurant, we got to know these things. So
So if you go to a restaurant and you say, you know, how long has your bottle been open? Huh? Have you guys thought about doing that? Sake is a perishable beast, right? When you make a bottle of sake, when the brewer ferments and makes it and releases it, he wants you to taste that flavor of sake between 15 and 18 months after it was bottled. After that, since it's perishable, it's on the outside. It's going away. It's getting bad, in a manner of speaking, and it's starting to degrade a little bit. And you don't catch the flavor or the intention of the brewer outside of, you know, 18 months. So there's a dating system. Start looking at bottles, and you can see dates on them. They have a release date on a lot of the bottles. Another factor is when you go to the restaurant and you see something that's down to about here, you know it's been open. You know it's been oxidized. So a lot of people will ask me, well, how long does sake keep in the refrigerator? Or how long does it – is it like wine? Again, there's a war. There's a battle. I fight against wine every day. Wine wins the battle where you can lay down bottles year after year, right? Because it has a sulfites in it. It has a longevity to it. Sake, you don't really do that. We'll talk about one category, but you don't do that in general. So wine wins. But when you open a bottle of wine, what happens? It oxidizes. Do you like drinking wine the next day, the day after that? Not really. Sake, put the cap back on it. By the way, twist off industry. All the Yongom being the smaller bottles are all twist off, which is actually really great. Put it in your refrigerator, and you won't notice a flavor change for about 4 or 5 days in the refrigerator. Now, I keep bottles of sake in my refrigerator up to 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. But I want people to think in terms of the orange juice factor. When you open a thing of pasteurized orange juice, is it done the next day? No. It stays. It's longevity. So,
question. What?
Do you want us to
start? Yeah, fire.
Let's go. Oh, because we're going to ask questions along. So we have till 7, correct? I've always wanted to use a gavel, by the way. Winner! Chicken dinner. I love your question. It's a great question. Does everybody understand that? So when you're milling rice, you're polishing rice, you're removing all these outside nutrients, in a manner of speaking. The outsides grain, the jumai outsides go to pickle farmers and pig farmers and picklers. They pickle vegetables with that. Then pig farmers also use it as feed. Now, going inside, those premium insides, they send to confectionaries, and they make candies and kind of tea treats and things out of it. It's a good question. Almost book-quality question.
Question about the rice itself. Here in this country, are any of the rice-growing areas, like I'm from Arkansas, where there's a lot of rice grown, and I would guess that it's probably not great rice because it's grown
in mass. We're not growing great rice yet. We're not. Hopefully one day we'll get there. But the history, remind me to speak about the history of sake kind of coming into the States, if you will. There are manufacturing plants here. Who's ever been to Shochikubai in Berkeley? They make sake right across the bay. Yeah, and they make in L.A., and they make in Oregon, and they make in Brazil, and they make in Australia. They're not making great products. I'll tell you a quick story. There's a huge brewery called Gekkan. The head of Gekkan Japan, the guy is like 6'5". He's very tall. And he came into my store, and we were circling around each other. He was with the head of Gekkan USA also. And he looked, and I had Gekkan from Japan in my store. But I did not have the locally made Gekkan. And he looked around, he walked around, and he looked at me, and he said, "Why don't you have my locally made Gekkan?" And I thought for a minute, and I said, "When you're at a party at home in Japan, would you ever serve your friends Gekkan made in the United States?" And I didn't mean to face him. I didn't mean to dishonor him. But I saw this. He was like, he got the point. And I got the point twice as loud back from him. I was like, "We just don't make a great product here yet. And one day we will. But for now, we don't." And I also have a policy in my store that if I carried one local sake, then I have to carry them all, and I don't. So I only deal in imported sake. Truthfully, I wish everybody's first sip of sake would come from Japan. That's how what a great product they can make there. Categories, rice. Any other questions? So this next brew that's coming out will be a Yamahai. How do I want to do this? Okay, so what do we know about rice? Again, the best rice are grown in different regions. So some brewers started saying, wait a minute, In this part of the country, they make great rice. So they started buying rice from different prefectures. Sake brewing rice is tall, really tall. It grows about almost over 6 feet tall. Who knows what typhoons are? The Japanese do. Now, in the wine world, when you talk about a grape, the quality of the grape dictates, they would say, 80% of the final product is dictated by how good the grape is, and 20% by the way they make the wine. Now, it's almost the inverse in the sake world. About 20% of the final product is dictated by how good the rice is. 80% comes down to technique. The production of sake, it's called the industry of 10,000 methods. Now, I will always go to these rice farmers, or the brewers, and I'll say to them, hey, what was that great brewing year? What was that great rice year? You know, I could ask Dave, what was that great grape year? And they always remember, oh, my God, that was the 72. We had the floods and the locusts, and it stressed the grapes, and it was great. I asked these rice farmers, what was the great rice year? And the guys, they're like, I don't know. I don't remember that. I was like, it's your business. They're like, huh. I was like, okay, what are the bad rice years? And that's when they're like, oh, 72. And I was like, why? Why? And he's like, because that's when there were typhoons. All their tall rice was blown over. And that was the year they had to work their butts off to achieve the same quality. They had to work that 80%, that 80% very hard. There is consistency in sake that there is not in wine. Since it is manufactured and it has about 80% to 20% ratio, you can make consistency year after year. Vintners can't do that because the grapes change almost every year. They can have some realms, but in the sake world, there is a huge consistency that goes year after year after year. And so that's why they have to work it to make it, to massage it, to make that brew taste like the year before. And when the rice is all hit the ground and germinated, bad news. These guys have bad rice, and they have to work twice as hard to make that flavor. Did you have a question?
So you already answered it. It was the same question that you had.
Okay.
About what happened to the end of the rice.
All right.
So is most sake made in the same rice?
No. Well, that's a good question. All right, I'm going to segue really quickly. Yeah, there are better brewing rices than others. So they found that over time, Yamada Nishiki became the great brewing rice. There's Omachi, Gohaki Mangoku, Miyama Nishiki. But there's a great brewing rice called Yamada Nishiki. And the reason why it's so great, hard on the outside, super absorbent on the inside. Good flavor makes a great sake. So a lot of people pay. There's a big market for buying Yamada Nishiki rice. From where? Hyogo Prefecture makes the best Yamada Nishiki. So it's so popular that brewers all over Japan will buy it from Hyogo or from some other prefecture to make their competition sakes, to make their high-end sakes. And for me, it's so popular that in the national competitions, they have their own segment. They have their own Yamada Nishiki category. So it's incredibly popular, and it for good reason. It makes a really good daiginjo, so in ginjo sometimes. And rarely do you find guys making Yamada Nishiki jumai, because they're less grades. You don't need that grade of rice to make a jumai or a hanjozo category. Water, agua, the second big component. Japan is known for really soft water. In the brewing industry, soft water is pretty key. And there were two great water centers. And all of sake kind of evolved around water. Now, when you see a bottle of sake, 80% of the final product is water. 20% is rice. So water is incredibly important. What's the killer? In water, iron. If iron is the absolute killer of sake, this is a great story. I couldn't believe it. And it was absolutely true. Brewers that are blessed with great water, they make great sake. There's no question about it. And predominantly, the best breweries were found in two places historically. One was in Kobe, and the other was in Kyoto, Fushimi area. These guys were blessed with brilliant water. They just made great sake because they had really beautiful water. In Kyoto, very soft water. They have oftentimes referred to very feminine sakes would come from Kyoto. In Kobe, they had a little bit harder water, but remember, on the world scale, it's still pretty soft. They would call those kind of masculine sakes. More sake is produced sort of in Kyoto and Kobe than anywhere else. They're the two major, and that's where all these little jizake, handcrafted breweries way back in the day, grew into macro breweries today. They have huge breweries, and they're based in Kyoto, and they're based in Kobe. So water is incredibly important. So much and so interestingly important that I was once at a brewery, and the owner walked me outside and he said, "This is our water source." And they're really proud of it. They have little kind of shrines or they have designated areas. "This is our water source." And I said, "Fantastic." And he said, "Before we had really bad water and we did not make very good sake." And I was like, "Oh." And I said, "Well, where did you get that water from?" And he said, "Right there." The distance was 20 feet. I was like, "You're pulling my chain." These guys, they love to pull my chain. I was like, "You're kidding me." He said, "Absolutely not. Depends on the filtration. Depends on what's in the ground that comes up and purifies the water." So he was devout. He said, "We now make great sake because of our water source here." So water is incredibly important. Can you taste water in sake? Absolutely. There's a lot of mineralities that you can taste in certain brews. All right, did everybody get the little one? Did you guys use your nose on that one first? I hope you did. This guy's a bombastic sucker, isn't it? Did people like this brew? A little too much. Ooh. First, I served at room temperature because it's a Jumai. Secondly, it's Yamaha. What is that? Is it like Honda? Yamaha method. Now, I will say this by saying that sake predominantly is brewed in the winter. All these small jizake, small breweries, all brew in the winter. Why? A couple reasons. One, who were sake brewers historically? Sake brewers were farmers. They'd farm in the fall, then they have nothing to do in the winter, so they became kurobito. They became brewery workers. So wintertime, best time to make sake for another very important reason. Cold, temperature. When you ferment something, it produces tremendous heat variations. And they didn't have air conditioning back then, so they'd open up the windows and allow the cool air to come in and cool down, and you could control your fermentation much better. Secondly, when it's cold, natural airborne yeasts don't wear parkas. They don't fly through. Natural airborne yeasts are something that you want to keep out of brews today. So the yeasts affect the quality of your sake. So if you brew in the winter, you don't have to deal with these things that are beautiful yeast that are floating on the rafters, beautiful yeast that come over the history of time that actually help shape the flavor of your sake. The Yamaha method is they allow some of those natural airborne yeast to propagate, to be part of the process, to sort of be a starter. Then they add these very special yeasts that we'll talk about in a minute that really help kind of do the fermentation process. But this guy has made the Yamaha method where it's kind of gamey. It's bigger, full-bodied. This is kind of like really masculine sake. Let me see a show of hands. Who liked this sake? Okay, who did not like this sake? If you guys were eating a big steak right now, I guarantee you'd like this sake a little bit better. Because it has pulled the flavors, pulled the oils a little bit more. Good meat pairing brew. Go.
I can't really tell if it's the cup shape, or is it sake clear?
It's a great question. I put in that smaller cup because I want everybody to be overwhelmed by the aroma. I wanted the nose to talk to them, to smell. What was the nose different than the other brews? The color. When you make sake, predominantly these guys use charcoal filtration, and they will filter to make it clear. And in terms of salability, drinkability, it's nicer to drink a clear fluid. In fact, when I do my competitions, when I do sake competitions, I'm always using a cup like this when I'm a judge or I'm judging sakes. Two reasons. One, very square side, straight sides for better aroma. Two, the concentric circles allow me to see clarity issues in the brew. So if you strip everything out of it, all the bad meanies, then it's a very clear brew. And back in the day, people used to think, oh, then that made a better sake. I like as they leave the natural color of the brew. This guy is more resembling of the natural color of sake. So I like that. And there's a movement to come back to not do so much charcoal filtration. If I ask these guys in that row back there, perceived what prefecture makes the best sake, I'll ask you guys, Tsushima-san. In Japan, what prefecture do you think makes the best Nihonshu? Yamagata, nice. You're from Yamagata. Historically. I don't want to put him on the spot. He's going to say Niigata. Yeah, he did say Niigata. There's a perception that Niigata makes great sake. Why? Historically, Niigata was very important because they shifted the sake industry. Sake used to be very fat, cloying, sweet, almost like the brew they just had right there. Niigata did the first of the really making light, dry sakes. They made light, dry, flavorful sakes, but they started using charcoal filtration to the nth degree. They started filtering everything out so it's super clean and super pristine. So some of the breweries that made the most marks on the industry were based in Niigata. So many people think that Niigata makes the best sake. They also have a ton of breweries in Niigata, and they win a lot of gold medals every year at the national competition, which, they did this year. All right, look at the clock here. Let's hold in 1 second. I want to talk about this brew. And if this sake is big and gamey, you guys wouldn't drink this. The best thing about sake is it's of all the beverages, it has the greatest temperature swings. Now, I could take this brew and I could lightly warm it and serve it to you guys warm. You would love it. It would taste fantastic. Sake goes from frozen to volcanic, nuclear. And there's a perfect temperature for every brew within that spectrum. It changed, you said 23 years ago?
23 years
ago. Yeah, the premium ginjo, premium sakes have come more online. Historically, before that, it was sort of traditional futsushu, regular sake, which were meant to be warmed. I'll kid you not, Japan is cold a long part of the year, and there's nothing more therapeutic and nice than drinking a nice atsukan, nurukan, nihonshu, and that's the reason why we drink out of those little cups, those little ochoko. Because it keeps the sake warmer long, quicker, and then you refill it, and it's not like a big coffee mug where it gets cold too quickly. That's why you drink out of those. Premium sakes, daiginjo, ginjo, you drink predominantly chilled. So there is 42 years ago, there's a big ginjo movement led by Koshino Kanbai in Niigata Prefecture. So the transformation was they're starting to drink higher end, more labor intensive, more kind of expensive sakes, and you don't really want to heat it up. The last category we're drinking, Daiginjo, you would never really want to heat this brew. Now, back to some tips. If you have a bottle of sake that's sitting in your refrigerator and you forgot about it and it doesn't taste that great, I mean, by all means, taste it. If it tastes a little bit off, warm it up because there's a very good chance you can capture the flavor again. It drinks pretty well. When the United States, in the 70s, the first batches of sake were coming over. And it was predominantly the Japanese food companies that brought sake over along with their nori, chopsticks, and they went to a brewer and said, oh, we're going to, the States. Do you have any sake that would do well in the States? And they're like, see that vat over there? Take that. Send that over there and tell them to heat it up. Like, heat it up. So it became like this masking agent. So we've been drinking pretty crappy hot sake. And predominantly because of monetary reasons, you would warm up your lesser brews. So we were drinking hot, crappy sake. Jumai.
Are we drinking
when we go to Katsushi? 10 out of 10 times. The only exception is like one or two restaurants. You will be drinking, if you order a hot sake, a brew that's made in Folsom, California, or Los Angeles, or in Berkeley, California. They will not, unless you're in a really great restaurant, they're not warming the good brews. But to ask them that. And you know what's sad? Sometimes you'll say, can I have a cold sake? And they'll take that hot, crappy box sake and chill it for you. And like, there you go. Woo! And by the way, when you do that, feel these guys out. Because, you know, sake is an industry now. It's a business. These guys make money, and they're starting to add more and more brews, and they're really using it as a way to make money. Say to them, do you have, you know, premium sakes? Do you have, and then are you just giving me the house sake that's, you know, chilled? Also, don't let them give you ochoco. Don't let them give you little cups. Ask for your sake in a white wine glass. Ask for it in a bigger vessel. I'm going to take you in just 1 second, but I just segued really quickly. What do you drink out of? Who's ever seen one of these magical guys? Kind of cool, hey? Fun, dorky, goofy. I love drinking out of kind of a square. I thought it was very novel and very cool. Do you know why these masu came around? Back in the day, there's a term called izakaya. It's like a pub. It's a guy who would set up a little stand where workers, laborers would come, and they didn't have a lot of money, and they're like, am I going to eat tonight or am I going to drink tonight? Oh, okay, I'm going to drink. So they'd go to these guys. Sometimes these guys had fake little ceramic cups for them where they think they were getting a good pour, but it was heavy, and it just didn't work. So they have to in Japan, this is a measurement of rice, consumption rice. Level it, you know what you're getting every time. So the guy said, why don't you serve me my sake in that? And they're like, okay. They started drinking sake out of the masu. It achieved two things. One, it was a fair pour. Two, the wood would actually sort of enhance the flavor of the crappy brew. It was a little bit of a masking agent as well, too. So it enhanced it a little bit. Now, some restaurateurs, because some of these guy guys are really cute, they'd say, I know you're drinking and thank you. I don't have food for you, but I'll put a little salt on the corner for you. So that's your dinner, right? So you're getting your minerals while you're drinking. Or they would put like a little miso paste also, you know, skoshi miso. So if you ever see that. Now, Daiginjo, premium sakes, what do you drink out of? Well, 8 years ago, the Riedel company came to Japan and wanted to do the definitive sake glass. So they went to a bunch of brewers. Some of these guys were really good friends of mine. They went to the media people. They went to a couple celebrities. And they brought everybody in for a conference. And they did all these glasses. They did all these testings for, a week. And they were like, this is it. We're defining the ultimate, you know, sake glass for the West, if you will. So this thing is shocking looking. So be prepared because it is dramatic. And I don't know how they achieved this, but honestly, be prepared. Drum roll, please. A Viognier Chardonnay glass, white wine glass, perfect sake drinking glass, right? No, because it was kind of, first of all, you drink different categories of sake out of different glassware. Jumai, Ginjo, Daiginjo. Some do better in a bigger cup. If I had a little ochoco and I drank all my sake out, would you drink your wines out of a little cup like that? No. Acidity distribution, it's the most important thing with any alcohol. If you drink out of a little cup, it puts all the sweetness on the tip of your tongue every time. Bigger vessel, it absolutely distributes the acidity through your palate more. Bigger pour. So this was a joke. It was really a joke. But now they do a certain different glass. They go to O series. Do you know why there was no stemware in Japan? Historically, what? Earthquakes? Who said earthquakes? I almost give you a book too for that, but no. Kimonos in serving, it would knock everything over. So, all right, let's pour that last brew. And this is the high end. Now, I didn't get to talk about who wants to know about the production, how you make sake. I can do it really quickly. All right, let's go through it really quickly. I usually do it sake in 3 minutes, but I'm not going to do it. Get drinking, people. Get drinking. Holy gorgonzola. All right, since we're on this brew, there's three uns. I'll talk about production in half a second. There are three uns in the sake world. Uns, three of them. The first one is unpasteurized. Sake, as I told you, is pasteurized. In fact, there's a 300 years before that guy, Louis, did a great branding marketing job and coined pasteurization, Japanese sake brewers were heating their sakes for preservation. They absolutely, if they invented Louis Pasteur. The guy copied them somehow. He ripped it off. Three uns. So typically, you would drink sake that's been pasteurized, hire, twice, pasteurized twice. Most sakes are pasteurized twice. If they don't pasteurize a sake, it's called nama sake, unpasteurized sake. The second un is unfiltered, the word we use in the States, unfiltered. That is nigori. Who's ever seen the cloudy, white, milky sake? Who likes nigori? Raise your hands. I like to say it's drinking without thinking. It's such a fun, fluffy bum rush of flavor. It's cool, right? It's in, it's direct, and woo, I love it. But you don't get the nuances. You don't get the subtleties. So that is nigori, or unfiltered sake. The third un is genshu. Gensh. This brew you're tasting right now is a genshu. It is undiluted. This guy is 18% alcohol. And so they don't add the water. They don't bring it back. Why? The brewers feel that this brew drinks better at this state of being. Now, acidity. On your sheet, you'll notice there's the sake meter value, the SMV, the magical Nihon Shudo. That is a system where they will measure the residual sugars at the end of every fermentation cycle. They'll put a hydrometer in there and they'll measure. The higher the number, the drier the sake. The lower the number, the sweeter the sake. So if I just told you that, using your cheat sheets, what is the sweetest sake that we're going to taste tonight? The last one. But this one is down there as well, in a big way. So now, here's one thing that I like to say. A starch sweetness is different than a grape sweetness or a juice sweetness. People will come into my store and say, I do not like sweet wines. And I'll say, well, that doesn't mean you don't like sweet sakes, because there is a difference. They aren't as sweet. This guy is a really sweet sake by the scale. This guy also has something very interesting. This guy has an acidity, Sando, of 1.9, super high acidity. The reason why they do that is they're balancing off the fruit. They're using high acidity to take that fruit down a little bit in terms of balance. Who likes this brew? Are wine drinkers saying that? Yeah, wine drinkers tend to like kind of genshu or higher acidity sake. It just has more body for them. Speaks to more of their wine points. Those all. You can't get drunk. And you know, a good point though, and these guys, they're proof. Nihonshu is something that I can go to whole dynamics of kind of alcohol and the culture and stuff like that. But they're right, you can't drink a lot of this. And it's not for not getting drunk. This is kind of too sweet. So if you are going to hunker down and have a drinking session, you'd want kind of a drier Jumai that doesn't have the sweetness to it, because then you can have cup after cup and see you later. Go ahead.
Are the SMV and acidity numbers on bottles?
It's a good question. Some, but not often, not always. No, they don't. I'd say 70% maybe in Japan you can find the information you're looking for. But I could pour a brew like you're drinking on at 1.5, which is very low, and I can pour a 6, which would be a drier sake. And it's a generalization, because sometimes a 6 will taste even more fruity than the 1.5. You'd swear it's like, oh, it's not as sweet. The other one's as sweet. So when people come in the store, it's like, I only like SMVs above 3. I always sneak them like a 1 or a 0. I have a personal philosophy. I think when you make sake, if you make it really dry, if you allow it to really ferment and have the yeast eat the glucose really to make it super dry, you lose body. I think there's much more body in a little bit more sweeter, let's call it fruitier brews. Okay, we're going to talk about production really quickly. Dozo, sorry, go.
Quick question. SMV, is it a numerical value, but is it specific to something, or is it subjective?
Oh, it's a very specific number. The Brahm scale, there's different scales. This is an industry standardized scale, absolutely. It's not a thumbsuck scale. Spring, shoots, rice, you're growing it, you plant it. In the fall, you harvest it. When you harvest rice, you got to let it acclimate. You take it down, you put it through machines, you separate to get to the kernels. Then you put it on milling machines. They used to use water wheel mills to make it. So they use these milling towers. Everybody can go to the production page really quickly, actually. This will help me. We can go faster. So once you've milled rice, you've polished it, you've taken out off the outside of each grain, that rice is pissed off. Half of their body's been ripped off, right? They're just like angry, and they're tight, and they're pissed, and they're angry. And what you have to do is you have to let it acclimate. So they'll set it in a room for about 2 weeks while it kind of moisturizes itself from the ambient humidities that are there. So then you're ready for, actually what you're doing is you polish it. Step two is you wash it. You have to wash off all this sort of bran off it. Then you soak it. Soaking is an incredibly important step because you have to bring that rice grain up to a level where it's got moisture, so when you steam it, it steams and cooks essentially better. Daiginjo sake, the premium sakes that we're about to have, I guess we're going to have to shoot that off pretty soon, they will let it soak for seconds. They have a guy with a stopwatch, and it's in the water, and he put it in the bucket, and he counts 15, 20 high-end Daiginjo sakes, the rice soaks for maybe 35, 40 seconds. It's fascinating. Sake is incredibly labor-intensive, incredibly labor-intensive. Then what you do is you steam the rice. Step five, sacrification. They use mold in the process. You guys are drinking mold. Mold is a beautiful thing. Mold is a wonderful thing. Every batch of rice, they take about 20% of that batch and they take it to a room where they sprinkle magical mold on it. The mold starts breaking down the starch into a glucose. So this happens for about 2 nights. They let this mold, think of your shower, steamy, hot, moldy. That's what you want. And these rooms are steamy, hot, and moldy. Here's a little fascinating fact. There aren't a lot of women in the industry. Why? Because you got to make sake all night long, and you're in these hot, steamy rooms. And so these guys didn't want their brewing guys and women to... So they made up all these things. They said, like, because of women's menstruation cycles, they are high in alkaline, and they mess with the brew. But it was really... The owners were like, no, we just didn't want any shenanigans or hanky-panky going on. Now there's a lot of women in the industry, which I kind of like. Mold? Yeah, it's a great question. And they have their special yeasts as well. Mold, there's predominantly... You guys know how to make soy sauce. Do you guys know how to make these same things? It's a mold. There are proprietary molds that they use, and they generally all use basically the same sort of mold. That's standard. The yeasts is where guys go crazy, and there's a bunch of beautiful different yeast varieties as well. So they sprinkle the mold on, right? Sacrification. Then who knows how to make bread? You know, you need a yeast starter, right? So that yeast starter's principle also happens in the sake making process. Step six, they use the yeast starter. Then they start adding these together in these big tanks that keep increasing. Basically, when you think of sake being made, it takes about 30 days. So it ferments for about 30 days. Then you'll see the fermentation period. Then they filter it. They remove kind of the lees, the unfermented rice particles. And then they'll do the second filtration, which is like a charcoal filtration, pure water system. A lot of guys aren't doing that. Then they pasteurize it. Then they store it. When you have fresh sake, typically it's pretty brash, pretty bright, pretty big. You want to do that last sake? And so they will lay it down. So these brews that you're tasting tonight, they've allowed to like sit for about 6 months before they release them. Then they release them, and that's why I say look at the bottling date. Namazake or unpasteurized sake, they release immediately. But on the whole, think of a bottle being, you know, set down for about 6 months before they release it. Sorry, you first.
No, I was just going to ask, the unpasteurized sake, do they
want flavor? They're three-dimensional. I will honestly say sometimes they're very big. They're very yeasty. They're very bright, high acidity, high fruit sometimes. A lot of times, genshu. They're just more impactful. That's why guys like it. So then at the end, you blend the tanks so there's consistency. You add water, bring it down, next pasteurization, then bottle release. Everybody knows how to make sake, right? It's not a distillery. All right, last brew, Daiginjo. When you make sake in the winter, you don't start by making the first batch your Daiginjo. It's like pre-season. You go and make your crappy sake first. The stuff that sort of pays the bills, truthfully, the common brew, the futsushu, the table sake. You practice, you get your team in motion, then you start making the ginjo, and then at the end, that's when you fire your Daiginjo up. You use special tanks, special rice. It's sort of the pride of the industry. A lot of people say, oh, the Daiginjo is the God's gift to the people. A lot of breweries will measure themselves by how great a Daiginjo they can make. As a category, I like it, but I don't think it's the end-all be-all. I'm kind of a Jumai guy. I like the lower end. I think there's more kind of depth and structure and flexibility. High-end Daiginjos are great gifting sakes. What do you guys think of the wakatake? How many people have had wakatake before? Yeah, I kind of wanted to have it because then you'd have it on top of other flavors. I always think it has a good acidity balance to it. Do people like the Daiginjo, or have I talked you right out of it?
More
labor-intensive. You mill it more. you pamper it more and you love it more, and anything you love more you have to pay more for, right?
How much difference?
Pricing? Daiquiris are very expensive. Yeah, they're out there. And, you know, let me rephrase that. I'm a retailer in the United States. In Japan, they're a little bit more affordable. But on the whole, a lot of people don't drink that much Daiginjo, I'll be honest. Again, it's special occasion, one glass, gifting. Now, I'll finish by saying that the sake industry in Japan is going down the toilet. Literally going down the toilet. Now, the reason why I say that is twofold. One, you're drinking premium sakes, and the handcrafted premium industry is kind of going like this. But in Japan, most people drink futsushu, or regular, common table sake, and that is literally going down the toilet. Breweries are closing, the sales every year decreasing almost by 7% every year. It's a bloodbath. Two reasons. One, the demographic for sake. The prototypical drinkers are guys, you know, the ages of 40 to 90. And it's like sake is perceived as your father or your grandfather's drink. A lot of younger drinkers, a lot of women do not drink sake or historically haven't. So brewers are actually going out and trying to make new style sakes, lower alcohol, fruitier, trying to attract a different market. So that is the one case. The people just aren't kind of drinking it. Now, Japanese also have a perception where they'd rather drink something that is not them. They'd rather drink Scotch whiskeys. They'd rather drink California Chardonnays. And so it's kind of pedestrian for Nihonshu. But the industry itself is not doing that great. How tight are we on time?
Oh, we're fine.
We're fine? All right, why don't I do this? So we talked about the categories, Jumai, Ginjo, Daiginjo. We talked about how you make sake. We talked about how you store it, how you keep it. You talk about how to buy it if you go to a restaurant. We talked about the glassware to use. We've talked about... I forgot the most important thing, food. I want everybody to think outside the box. I want you guys, these brews that you're tasting now, can you visualize? Can you think, well, I'd like to maybe throw something at this? The Genshu, the undiluted brew, that's one of the best cooked fish sakes in the business. I wrote that on those notes. If you're steaming something, if you're grilling a fish, phenomenal. Great acidity, good fruit, brings out and tremendous flavor profiles. I do a sake challenge once a month. I read a newsletter through my store called truesake.com. Actually, the Chronicles followed me a couple times. I take sake to Western restaurants. I take sake to French restaurants. I take it, just last week, went to a Senegalese restaurant. And I believe in sake. I think it's incredibly useful, like I said. It is a powerful tool, and I will stack up anything that comes from the ocean. I think sake goes better with that than any wine ever could, and I've done countless tests. So I think a starch does better with food pairing sometimes than a grape juice does. All right, I will end on questions. Just fire them away. You haven't asked one. Yeah, absolutely. People do use sake has a higher alcohol content, and restaurants that have beer wine licenses don't have mixers, so they use sake in there to raise the alcohol of certain cocktails. Absolutely, you can. You can infuse sakes. You can add things to them. My book, The Chronicle, wouldn't have published it if I didn't add cocktails in the last pages. So I'm a purist. I'm not a snob. Drinking is a luxury. Do with whatever you want. But they do make sake cocktails, sake teenies, and things like that. So good question. Phenomenal. No, I mean, just like wine, some work, some don't. But sake goes very well. There are certain lactic acids in sake, especially Yamaha's, Kimoto methods. Certain lactic acids go really creamy and do very well cheeses. There's a whole cheese exploratorium. Trust me, sake is big. I almost brought a Daiginjo tonight that every tasting that the brewer goes to, he brings blue cheese to go with his Daiginjo. Sake and cheese is phenomenal. Again, it's that good kind of starch component. Sorry, I'm going to hit him first and then you. Good question. What do you guys think?
Number one.
Yeah, good. Why? Just because it's called what? A ginjo. Could you tell that there was alcohol added to that?
Yes.
No, you think? Now, I tell you what. I will say yes, and you're shaking your heads. If I had served that last or in the middle, I don't think you could have. But again, it was that first sip of sake. I think it tastes kind of boozy.
Hi.
Where are you going to be on the 24th? What? Yeah, because that is the 250th anniversary of Guinness, right? They're having the big one. All right, sorry, go.
Cool.
Oh, Sino-san. I'll get back to you. All the way in the back. No. Remember, they brew for 30 days, the fermentation. They allow it to rest for 6 months. Good question. You'll see on the sheet there's a category called koshu, aged sake. I think that's the next frontier. I think a lot of wine drinkers, sherry and port drinkers are going to like koshu. Absolutely. Very small segment. But it's aged. They make sake specifically to age. In my store, I sell a 1972. In my store, I sell, you know, these ones that they age at different temperatures to bring out different flavors. They drink very big and earthy and mushroomy and skunky, but really beautiful. Skunky in a good way.
If they're aging, do they store in?
Different things, yeah. Enamel cask or bottle. If it's really cold, it never changes color. Sake that's aged almost goes to like a soy sauce color. It'll go to that color unless you keep it incredibly cold. So, and it's not barrel aged, so it's not pulling the colors of the wood. They certainly, it's in enamel, or it's in stainless, or it's in bottle aged. By the way, keep your sakes out of the sun, just like wine. UV light destroys sake.
If you have an aged sake, now will it keep the same as an ordinary sake? Would you have to drink it a lot quicker?
Oh, once you open it? No, it's the inverse. You can actually keep it longer.
Do you
have sake tasting tips?
I do. We organize once a month. I don't have this is San Francisco. TrueSake.com. Yeah, we have an events. We have a newsletter that talks about events. I don't do tastings in the store as the license. Took me a year and a half to open that store. But the next one will be different. Sorry. $2 chuck. Yeah, you can get really, remember, there's different reasons for drinking. Some people drink because they want to get screwed up. And so higher alcohol content sake, they do that. So those are, you know, workers. They want to, who knows what a one cup is? There's a great lines of sake called one cups where they literally, you go to a vending machine, pop in coin, it pops out, they rip the lid off and they chug it. He knows one cups. I've seen a guy on a bicycle with one cups in both hands wheeling, opening both through the most crowded street you've ever seen without making contact. It was impressive. All right, I think why don't we end on you?
You mentioned that you drink beer first and then go to sake. What was the reason for that?
There's a bunch of different philosophies. Maybe I would get the definition from those guys, but beer is refreshing. A lot of times people say, like, I'm very thirsty, so beer is considered a quencher, and then Nihonshu isn't as quench oriented. It's more satisfy.
So
they're
like
just go straight to sake. You.
Sorry. First of all, for those of you who haven't been to a store, I highly recommend it. It's beautiful, and I'd like to just to talk about briefly though your taste match system, also which restaurants in the Bay Area have the best sake lists.
That's a good question. Taste Match I already spoke about. Remember the footholds? I developed that program to talk about beer and wine profiles. That's Taste Match. That's a kind of a registered system to get people. If you can speak to your beer and wine profiles, we can put you in a bottle of sake. You guys can buy my book, too, if you want, whatever. It talks about that a little bit more in depth. But it is to help people. You know, when you walk into a wine shop, send me down the Chardonnay aisle, and I know what I'm looking for. You know basically the different areas. But I had to develop Taste Match just to get people to understand a little bit more foothold stuff. The second part was?
Which restaurants in the Bay Area have the best?
God, man, it's very political, by the way. If you want to spend money and if you want a great list and you want to go do good tasting, wide variety, sort of good by the glass, there's a place called Ozumo down on the Embarcadero. It's a little bit pricey, but they have a very good sake list, and you can do a lot of exploration. Sushiran. Yeah, who said Sushiran? Great. Yoshitome's place. Sebo is a very small menu. I do menu construction for people. So right across from my store is a little restaurant that I do seasonal things. We have 7 sakes all the time, paired with fish specifically. I'll see what the fish are, and we'll pair specifically for that. Sebo restaurant. I went for the first time. I did a tasting down there a couple months ago. And, yeah, he has a very good sake menu, and he's totally sake enthusiastic. He and I – say again?
I'm
Anzu? Yeah, Fred is a good guy. Fred, I help Fred with their menu. I do a lot of tastings at Anzu restaurant. So, which one? Non? It's not coming. You know, you go to Limon. Do you know the Peruvian? They're fun. They're starting to play in that game. I need you guys to go out now and say, hey, as you're in your steak restaurant, say, give me a big Jumai. We need a Yamaha here on the table. I'm not joking. This is a push system, man. There, and just tell them, we'll buy it. Yeah, their sommelier will. Yeah, so. And again, I want those guys to not think of sake as kind of the redheaded stepchild. It's legit. It is a legit beverage. I hope nobody was redheaded stepchild.
Other than your store, is there any other stores, places
to be
buying sake?
Yeah, again, there's a place on Divisadero called Corkage. There is a, Costco sometimes does it, and they'll have a good line. They won't have the big stuff. If you go to Safeways, they have locally made sakes, not too much imported stuff. But Better End Wine Storage will have a little sake section. But it's my job because I go there and it's all dusty and discolored, and you can look at it and it's like, that's yellow, really yellow. It's supposed to be clear, you know. So a lot of people just defer. They go to True Sake. There's a nut there that we can't even compete.
And also the Japanese food stores, which
might Nijiya Market. Simon's, I can't believe I forgot that. Nijiya has a very good, in Japantown, Nijiya has a very good sake selection, and it's fresh, pretty fresh inventory. And
which is also where the crackers came from. Someone asked.
Yeah, I brought those from Nijiya. Nijiya, hi. You like those? Didn't I cut you off already? Yeah. Hi. You're going right to money, aren't you? You were supposed to be at that other seminar earlier, weren't you? Isho Bean. These guys are more value. Truthfully, the better value is in the Isho Bean, the bigger bottle.
What's the volume of that?
60 fluid ounces, 1.8 liter. And then Yongon Bean is 24 fluid ounces. It's 720 milliliter, unlike wine, which is 750 milliliter. And then we have 300 milliliters and 500 milliliters for tasting as well. Do you really want to go there? How much were your ticket prices? All right. You know what? I'm going to give you the Yongon Bean size price, okay? Which is like the wine bottle size, if you guys want. Dewa Zakura, the Oka, that guy is $30 for a wine size. Chikurin, the Fukumare, is $24. Then Tengumai, I think, is like $24 as well. Umenishiki Sakahitosuji is $28. And then the Wakatake is $42. Thank you for saying that. I agree. But sake is expensive, I'll be honest. I don't have a huge markup, but it just comes over expensive. These are all 20%, I think 20% added on because they're coming over. We have aged sakes and dessert sakes. Come to the store. It's right in your market. It is. It's fruity. Again, I want to go out with you, woman. All right, anybody else? Oh, Cleedocle. Oh, wait, we didn't give the book away. Oh, God. Does anybody remember a great question? You had good questions.
Right, sir, I want to that one. Didn't I say it was almost... So then I think did I describe yours? Yeah, so sake, the 2,500-year-old fad.
Cool, thank you.
Thank you, Bo. Thank you very much. So, our thanks to Bo Timken and for his sake tasting. We also like to thank our audience. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion and drinking, is adjourned.